Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Thanks for listening to this program, and I hope you enjoy it, because listening is what this show's all about every week. But in this episode, that's especially true. Our guest is Nina Kraus. Nina is a neuroscientist and the Northwestern University Hugh Knowles Professor of Neurobiology, Communication Sciences, and Otolaryngology. That's the medical specialty that deals with the head and neck, where our speech and hearing organs are located. Her new book chronicles her work at BrainVolts, a lab devoted to the study of sound and the mind. Titled Of Sound Mind, How Our Brain Constructs a Meaningful Sonic World, the book is a tour of force of the physics of sound, our sense of hearing, and most fascinatingly, how our brains process and use sound for some of our most important cognitive functions, from communication through language acquisition to our appreciation and ability to create music, to making sense of the world around us by the sounds of everyday life. It's fun and a fascinating read, and I think you'll also enjoy our conversation with its author, Nina Kraus. And I'm really enjoying this book, Nina. It's fascinating.
I'm glad you like it.
I'm curious about, you know, how you got interested in sound. When did this begin for you? When was it your interest in biology and neurobiology in general, or when did sound become your focus?
Well, I'll bet it became my focus when I was in my mama's womb. And I could hear all the sounds sloshing around in there and her heartbeat. You know, sound is all around us. And, you know, when I, after I was born, I grew up in a house where more than one language was spoken, and my mom was a pianist. So there was a lot of music all the time. You know, I guess, at some level, I must have realized that sound is important, that sound is what connects us, which is, in fact, one of the big messages of my book, is that sound connects us. You know, when I went off to college, I majored in comparative literature because I liked to read and I knew some languages. But then I took biology and decided that was for me. And fortunately, I ran into a book called The Biological Foundations of Language. And I thought, oh, so I can actually combine these loves. And, you know, slowly but surely, I worked towards, you know, getting a doctorate in neuroscience with the focus on sound and the brain and what happens in the brain when sound acquires meaning.
Yeah, and you have a lab there at Northwestern University called BrainVolts. Can you tell us about the genesis of that and what kind of work you do there? Because it's really quite the spectrum from music to language to concussion, you know, all kinds of things that you guys deal with.
Yeah, so first of all, it's called BrainVolts, and I encourage anybody listening to please have a look at the website, brainvolts.northwestern.edu. And you'll see on the homepage, you know, there are illustrations that show that we, in fact, work on music and rhythm, aging, development, reading, language, bilingualism. I'm sure I'm missing something. But what all of this has in common, you know, you might wonder, well, what are they doing at BrainVolts? What we are doing is we are engaged in trying to understand sound and the brain. So sound and the brain is the umbrella that encompasses everything we do.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really like about your book is you bring all of this to a level of understanding that, you know, somebody like me who's a non-scientist or, you know, not your particular scientific discipline, a lot of professors, you know, write textbooks and things like that. This book is meant for, you know, anybody to read, and it's so accessible. What made you decide to write this?
Well, you know, from the very beginning, I wanted my science to be rooted in the real world, in the lived world, outside of the ivory tower, as well as within. My favorite audience is what I might call the intellectually and spiritually curious outsider, you know, somebody who is not inside the necessarily a specialist in sound and neuroscience, but someone who wants to know more about the world around us. And as I mentioned, and you mentioned, all of the different topics that we talk about really have roots in social, educational, and medical interests. So it has always been important. And as I say, from really the just the get-go, you know, I realized that if I couldn't explain to my mother how I was spending my time, my mom, who's a musician, not a scientist, and you know, she would ask me, what are you doing? And I, you know, realized early on that it was very important for me to be able to explain to her, to anybody, how I was spending my time.
One of the things I find really fascinating is, you know, there are many modalities of learning that we have. Some people are very visual. Some people are very kinesthetic. They need to be hands-on, touching, moving, doing that. And some people, like me, are very auditory. There's a reason I like doing radio and doing a program like this, because I like to listen to these kinds of programs. I like to listen to music. I prefer to listen to a baseball game on the radio rather than watch it. And I'm wondering, you know, what is it about sound that, you know, is just creates such activity in the mind?
Well, the sound mind is vast. The hearing brain is vast. And hearing engages how we think, feel, move, and coordinate our other senses. So that's a lot. When I think historically, when people think about hearing, they think of the ear. But in fact, hearing happens in the brain, and it is so affected by everything we know, what we have remembered. You know, sound is movement inherently, and moving is very important. How we feel about sound and how we see sound in the context of our other senses. This is a vast and rich phenomenon, the hearing brain. And I would push back and say, you know, this idea of a dichotomy of people who are visual or people who are auditory. Anytime you are engaging with the world, you are engaging in multiple ways. Think about Beethoven, who you know, was deaf for a lot of the time that he was writing some of the best music that we have had the honor of listening to and sometimes trying to play. You know, he's just a testament to the fact that we engage our entire sound mind, which is vast, when we engage with making sense of sound.
Yeah, and when it comes to making sense of sound, let's talk about what sound is and how we perceive it. How that signal of vibrations in the world, sound waves, how we get that into our sound mind. So could you give us a little sound 101? Lead us through how the ear actually works, because I found this part of your book very interesting too.
Thank you. So, you know, sound is the movement of air molecules. The analogy of a visual item. If you think of a visual item, it will have a color, a shape, a texture, and it has ingredients, right? These kinds of ingredients that are very obvious because you can look at them. Sound also has ingredients. So yes, it's the movement of air molecules, but it's the movement of air molecules in particular ways that have ingredients like pitch, how high or low a sound is, the timbre, which is what are the harmonics, what are all of the different bands of energy that are being reinforced by whatever it is that is making the sound. There are so many kinds of timing the timing of when things start and stop, the timing within, you know, even the timing within a syllable. What distinguishes a ba from a da is very, very fast changes in frequency and pitch and harmonics over time. So sound consists of these different ingredients, and our brain needs to make sense of these ingredients. And one of the analogies that I, the metaphor that I use in the book is of a mixing board. So, you know, you can think of the sound ingredients. So think of a mixing bowl with the different ingredients of sound that gets poured into the brain. And the brain you can think of as a mixing board, which has faders, as you know, and all the different ingredients, the pitch, the timing, the timbre, the harmonics, loudness, all the different aspects of sound. Sound processing in the brain is not a volume knob. It's not as though all the ingredients are processed equally. They are processed differently by each of us, depending on our lives in sound. And we can learn about this because, you know, as I'm talking to you now, the neurons in your brain that respond to sound are producing electricity. And with scalp electrodes, we can measure that electricity and actually see how good a job your brain is doing at processing these sound ingredients. So it's really kind of wonderful to be able to break down the sound wave into these different ingredients and then break down the brain wave into these same ingredients and see how a particular brain processes the sound. We are able to not only look at the activity that we can measure, the electricity, you know, electricity is the currency of the nervous system, we can also sonify it. So we can play it back through a speaker. You know, right now, my voice is being fed through a microphone, and then it will be, this electrical signal will be played out through a speaker. In the same way, once I pick up the electricity from your brain, I can take that electricity and play that back through a speaker, and we can listen to the brain.
What I found really interesting was you use a very, one of my favorite songs of all time by the Beatles, A Hard Day's Night. And you play that very familiar melody from that, and you can see the waveforms and you hear what the sound, and we know, all most of us know that song and can recognize it. But then when you play it back, and I was wondering if you could, maybe we could do that, when you play that back, and listen to the brain waves that you've recorded for, it's like three different people, they have different characteristics to them, don't they?
Yeah, and that's really one of the big points of my book, which is that we all hear the world differently. So first of all, it's remarkable that, you know, when you play the sound wave and it sounds something like this, and then you measure the brain's response to sound, just the fact that it resembles the sound that it made the electricity fire is remarkable. So, you know, here's the sound wave, here's a brain wave. And then if you play the response from three different healthy brains, you can listen to the three brains and you can hear that each brain sounds differently because each brain is different. Mm-hmm.
and I can hear that it's a hard day's night with each brain, but it's different. And it's like, it goes back to that age old question of, you know, when I look at something that's red or green, you know, and I perceive that and I know that's red, that's green. And we can agree on that if as long as we don't have some form of color blindness. And yet, you know, is it true that we all see color the same way? And could you say the same thing that, you know, sound, we don't hear sound the same way or perceive it in our brains?
No, we don't see color the same way either. Mm-hmm. We really don't interface with the sights and sounds and smells in our world in exactly the same way. You know, there are certain things that we can agree on. For example, we can agree that it's a hard day's night. We can agree that it's a shade of red. But our own experience throughout our lives makes us hear and see the world in our own way, because, well, certainly the sound mind is very malleable. It's very flexible.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our visit with Northwestern University neuroscientist Nina Kraus as we talk about her work on our sense of hearing the world around us. And we're back. Let's continue now with our visit with neuroscientist Nina Kraus. Her new book, Of Sound Mind, delves into the sonic world our minds create through the sounds we hear, from language to music to a truck rumbling down the street. You mentioned the ingredients of sound, and I thought that was a great analogy of way of thinking about them, because as somebody that's, you know, taught physics, you know, I know what frequency is. I understand, you know, what pitch is. I know what harmonics are, you know, on a mathematical level. But you explain them so beautifully. And I was wondering if you could maybe just give us a really, you know, brief encapsulation of what is frequency and pitch. And then I want you to talk about timbre, because it's something that I never really understood until I read your book. And I want to thank you for putting the pronunciation in there, because I you know, anybody that looks at that word, T-I-M-B-R-E, I don't know how you would get timbre out of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, just even the distinction between frequency and pitch. So frequency is a physical property. It is how quickly air molecules are moving in the air. And if they're moving very, very rapidly at a very high frequency, then you will get a higher sounding sound than if it's vibrating more slowly. But the idea of pitch, that's a psychological term. So that's not something that you measure. You measure frequency, but it's not a one-to-one transfer of pitch and frequency. That said, when we listen for the pitch of a particular sound, one of the important ingredients that is determining the pitch we hear is the frequency of vibration. So that's one thing. And the other is, you know, similar dichotomy, if you will, can be talked about with respect to harmonics and timbre. So timbre is the perception of sounds being different. So for example, if you take two instruments that are playing the same note, a violin and a tuba, the pitch is the same, but they sound different. And so that's called the timbre. But now if you look at the physical characteristics of, you know, what is it that makes a tuba and a piano sound differently, you would measure the harmonics, which are bands of frequencies and resonances that are enhanced and which ones are suppressed. And they very much depend on, for example, the object that is making the sound. So, you know, a tuba is a different shape and size than a piano. And so the harmonics are going to be different. The harmonics are also what distinguish a da from a ba or a ga. And what is different when I say those different syllables is the shape of my mouth. And the shape of my mouth and my tongue and my lips, you know, this is an instrument that is changing shape. And as it changes shape, you will hear different harmonics that are happening very, very quickly. And that will help us not only in music, but in language.
Yeah, and we'll get to talking more about language later and the connection to that. One of the things that's always fascinated me is the idea that some people have perfect pitch, like they can recognize the beep of a microwave and tell you it's a middle C or whatever. And it's interesting when you talk about timbre that musicians that have really good pitch recognition tend to be able to recognize it with their instrument, like a violin. If they're a violinist, they're really good at that, but maybe not as well with a different instrument.
Yeah. So we call this specialization of the specialized. So, you know, if you take a musician, and by a musician, I really mean anybody who regularly plays a musical instrument. And typically, a musician defined in this way, their brain will do a pretty good job processing harmonics and various timing aspects of sound. But if you happen to be a trombone player, your brain, your sound mind is going to be especially tuned to the sounds of the trombone, because this is something that you have made these sound to meaning connections, and you have really thought about and remembered in enormous detail, and you've used your muscles. So you've moved along with this sound, and you have engaged your very, very vast sound mind, not only to have the enhancements that any musician will have, but it will also be specialized according to the instrument that we play.
Yeah, and you point out in your book, I think you mentioned that your husband's a musician, your mother is a musician, and, you know, music's such an integral part of our lives. I can't think of a single person who doesn't like music, at least to some extent. But you make it really clear in the book that musicians, they have this just amazing, more of a rich relationship to the soundscapes in their mind than non-musicians do. Could you explain that a bit?
Well, you know, biologically, we are what we do. So if you spend a lot of time making sense of sound and really listening for all of those different ingredients and producing all those ingredients in a flexible and fine manner, you will learn, your brain will learn to automatically respond to sound in a very fine-tuned manner, because the things that we do a lot of get reinforced. And, you know, I really talk about this from, you know, I'm a biologist. And so, you know, one of my very first experiences was to record from individual neurons. And so, you know, I was recording from an individual neuron that responded to sound. And the sound was the same, the neuron was the same. And an animal whose neuron this was taught that this particular sound had a meaning. So after a time, the animal learned that every time he heard the sound, lunch was coming. And so if you compared the response to the same neuron, to the same sound, and the same animal, once the sound had acquired meaning, you could see firsthand, I mean, this really made a huge impression on me, you could see firsthand that the neuron fired differently. So of course, the things that we do, the things that we spend a lot of time doing. If you are a musician, if you do stand-up comedy, if you're a sound engineer, if you're a bird watcher, anything that you do a lot of will change your nervous system and make you who you are.
Yeah. What about people who listen to music instead of necessarily making it? What would be the advantage to that if somebody listens very intently to music? Not just, music's on in the background, but on headphones on, eyes shut, and deeply immersed in the music on a regular basis. What would that be about?
Well, what we have been able to see is that, certainly listening to music affects you in the moment very, very strongly. The kinds of biological change that we have been looking at are ones where experience has fundamentally changed the way your brain responds to a sound, so that automatically when you hear a sound, your brain responds in, say, this enhanced manner, as we've seen in musicians with timing and with harmonics. And when you are making music, you are engaging your sound mind very deeply, because you are, you're thinking, remembering, moving, coordinating your other senses, and this is a very detailed process that will change your brain in a fundamental way. I like to say, you're not going to get fit watching spectator sports.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. And it's interesting when you watch somebody that is, really has mastered, like, say, the guitar, and they seem so effortless when they're playing. But, that's from many, many hours of practice and play. But that they are able to then just express themselves through that guitar without really having to think about where their fingers are going or anything like that.
Yeah. And I think that, that happens also as we speak a language. We don't have to think about how to produce and, what every word that we're saying sounds like, but we have a lot of practice speaking the language that we speak. And so it really is a matter of repetition and doing things a lot and doing things in a way that has meaning.
Well, our producer, Matt Fidler, is a musician and also a sound engineer. And we had an interesting discussion earlier, and I told him you should ask this question. So, Matt, would you please ask Nina your question about world music?
Yeah, thanks. Nina, music seems to have kind of this emotional undertone that seems universal, whether you're a musician or not. Like, you can really hear this, in a well-crafted movie soundtrack, for example. And when I was studying music in college, I was introduced to the Indian system of music, which is very different harmonically and rhythmically to most Western classical music. And I don't really get emotional responses from it. But I'm just wondering, why is that? Because I assume that Indian people do have a strong emotional response to it. And would the opposite be true with our system of music?
Sure. So let me just answer or try to answer your question with an analogy to language. So when we're born, we are citizens of all the world's languages. So any newborn child has the ability to produce, to make any of the sounds of any of the languages in the world. And as time goes on, that ability goes away. And what happens in its place is that the brain and the person becomes really good at the sounds that are meaningful to them. And so they develop that. And the same is true with music and with notation. Initially at birth, we are citizens of all the world's music, and it is a matter of the things that we listen to, the things that have meaning for us, the things that we spend a lot of time engaging with. These are the things that will shape and prune our brain, our nervous system, to respond to the things that are meaningful to us.
There's something I've noticed with all of my nieces and nephews is that they, especially at a very, very young age, they respond to reggae music. And maybe it's just the heartbeat, like a pulse that reggae has or something that's very natural. But have you found anything that's universal that people never lose, that maybe all systems of music or sound kind of take into account and we have this emotional response to?
Yeah, well, some form of rhythm. I mean, rhythm is huge. And I have a whole chapter in the book all about rhythm and the different kinds of rhythm. We can't just say rhythm, because when we start looking at that topic, there are different kinds of rhythm intelligences, if you will. But rhythm is a part of every music in the world. It is part of every language. And I think people very naturally think of rhythm as being, oh, that's a part of music, but it's a huge part of language too. It's the rhythm in language that really gives us a tremendous amount of meaning behind the words. I mean, you know, if you just, as I'm talking now, there are no pauses between individual words. Like there are no spaces as though the words were written, and yet you know what I'm saying largely because of the rhythm of the speech. And reggae has this very obvious pulse to it that I think is really something that anybody responds to at any age.
Ooh, and you mentioned in the book a bird called Snowball, I think is his name. And Snowball actually like moves with the rhythm of music. And I found that, I watched it this morning and I found that to be amazing. But there's a deeper idea going on here that that there's a connection between certain species that have that ability and ones that don't. And what are the animals that can do this? And what's the connection with to language?
Yeah, well, there's a huge connection to language. So, birds and some dolphins, elephants. Animals that are vocal learners. Your dog, for example. Your dog doesn't imitate. And in order to be a vocal learner, there's a lot of imitation going on. With a baby, babies will imitate the sounds that they hear. Birds learn by imitating the sounds of their father. So animals that are able to imitate sounds are then able to learn complex sounds. And your dog will always understand the word out, but he's not going to say it. So he's not going to imitate that vocally. Whereas any kid, if you say let's go outside, they may very well say, yeah, out. So it's very much a necessary part of being a vocal learner.
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm watching our 2-year-old granddaughter, Coral, who is, gaining this amazing facility with language. And it's so funny because when grandma's around, which she's visiting in Portland right now, she will imitate her. Like just the other day, I heard her say, well, I'm just a little bit tired, so I think I'm going to sit down now. And that was just copying grandma.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, babies are super good at that. And we're very good at imitating each other. And also, when you're having a conversation with somebody, we're so sensitive to underlying rhythms. If you're talking to somebody who's speaking really, really quickly, without you knowing it, like you're going to start speeding up. We're very sensitive to that. And babies, when they're learning language, one of the big ways that they learn is with their remarkable ability to imitate.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with neuroscientist Nina Kraus, author of the new book of Sound Mind, How Our Brain Constructs a Meaningful Sonic World. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. If you're just joining us, our guest is neuroscientist Nina Kraus, and we're talking about our sense of hearing, language, music, and sound, and how important they are to our human experience, and how richly our minds perceive the world around us through sensing and making sense of sound.
My view is that every child should have a musical education, and that music should be a part of everyone's education in the same way as, you know, learning to read and do math. So, you know, I talk about sound and the sound mind. So the hearing brain is vast. It engages so much of our brain. It engages how we think and move and feel and remember. And music is the jackpot. Music really challenges our movements and how we think and feel, and we have to remember passages, we have to pay attention, we have to resolve the complex information that you're getting both visually as well as through sound, and all of that needs to be combined. And it turns out, and one of the things that we've discovered in measuring sound processing in the brain is that the very ingredients that are enhanced in musicians are the ones that are most needed for language. So the harmonics and certain aspects of timing, these are ingredients in sound that we really need in order to be able to understand each other, to understand each other in noisy places, and importantly, to be able to read.
Yeah, and you also mentioned in the book, and I, as an educator, I'm retired now, but I've heard this many times from educational specialists that noise in a classroom, it can be really good if there's the kids are on task and they're talking to each other about what they're learning about, but it can also be just a cacophony for some kids where they can't make sense of what's going on. Could you talk a bit about how some of those kids that have those difficulties, how it can affect them, to that noise level in the classroom?
Yeah, well, noise affects all of us. And again, a big chapter in the book is about noise. And I've just written two pieces, one in the Wall Street Journal and the other in the LA Times. It just came out yesterday on sound and noise and its effects on our health. The first piece had to do with human health, and then the second had to do with the health of other living things like plants and animals. So noise, especially human-made unnecessary noise, gets in the way of all kinds of communication. So, there too, it's a matter of taking responsibility and a matter of deciding for oneself, this particular noise that I'm hearing, is it necessary? And if it's not necessary, you can get rid of it. And I think as a society, I'm hoping that we will become more aware of the sounds in our environment and, the way in which, because there's so much racket, it really makes it hard to listen, you know, to listen to what's important, be it in a classroom or as you're walking down the street. As a species, we're really losing our ability to listen because there is so much noise that often gets in the way.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate to live in a very quiet place, and I deeply appreciate that quiet. And when it's disturbed, I'm usually disturbed. One of the things I found very interesting as an educator is I used to take my classes on a field trip up to Lassen National Park. And one of the activities I would do with them is we'd go off on a trail and just sit quietly and I'd have them close their eyes and try to make as little sound as possible and just perceive the quiet. And then I would time it, and then after it would be 2 minutes. And then I would ask them after that period of time, how long do you think that was? And they almost all would say much longer than 2 minutes, that you know, because they hadn't experienced that kind of quiet before. It, you know, they were just so used to the noise in their daily suburban lives.
Yeah, no, our brain is really good at adapting. You know, so for example, and even with respect to noise, we've all had the experience of, you know, like we don't notice the rumble of the idling truck outside until he cuts the ignition. And then, you know, you kind of breathe the sigh of relief, realizing, oh, you know, there was a sound out there that I wasn't even aware of, but it clearly was making me tense. And I was clearly aware of it on some level, even though I wasn't actively paying attention to it.
One of the things I found also interesting, and I would have to say I'm probably guilty of this as well, is that if you were to poll people and say, if you're going to lose, you know, one of your senses, the one they least would want to lose is sight, and they would choose not losing sight over sound. And yet your research shows that sound plays such an immense role in our minds. I think that is like one of the big takeaways of your book and the work to me.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. It really is, because sound connects us. You know, right now, you and I are having a conversation in the moment. This isn't some, picture that we're looking at, you know, you and I are, you know, sound is dynamic. So, you know, once it's gone, it's gone. And it is a way of being present and alive in the world. You know, you and I are everyday improvisers. You know, we don't have a script. We're communicating through sound and listening to what the other has to say, and we're going back and forth. And this connection and the being present in the moment is something that sound does for us, which is so alive. It is really what makes so much of life exciting, the fact that you have a communication that is reverberating, it is going back and forth. It is something that Ian McGilchrist calls betweenness, this idea of connecting with whatever it is that you're connecting with in real time. And sound is completely, I mean, to me, it's the poster child. It's emblematic of this idea of betweenness, because it connects us. It connects us, especially in, you know, in a time when the world is fragmented. We are not very empathic. We are disconnected from many of our institutions and our world. It is more important than ever. I mean, I think it's always been important to connect, but it is especially important now to be able to be in the moment and to honor what is happening as we are actually experiencing this betweenness, this communication from one person to another. And sound really helps us do this.
Yeah, I can always tell if I'm listening to an interview, I can always tell if somebody's got a prepared question and they're just reading it rather than listening to the person they're talking to and then maybe having an idea of where they want to go and what they want to talk about, but, you know, not really interacting with their guest and being in the moment and present with them. Yeah. And that really is the gift of human communication.
It is, and which is also why performances are, you know, live performances are so exciting, and also why improvisation in music is so exciting. You know, I mean, just like someone who is preparing for an interview, yeah, you prepare. You have an idea of the kinds of ideas that you would like to cover. You've done your homework. But then what happens, you know, as Herbie Hancock has said, you know, when he asked, what does he do when he improvises? And he says, you know, it's often a complete surprise. You know, he spends hours and hours and hours playing, and he understands music. He understands his instruments. But then what is exciting is, you know, what happens when you are now faced with an audience or faced with a piano or faced with a person who is asking you a question in their own way, in their own personal way, in a way that has meaning for them.
Well, we're, you know, getting towards the end of our visit here, sadly, but I would like to know, what are some of the things you really want to explore further in your work? What are some things that are, you know, on the horizon for you that you really, questions you really want to find answers to?
Well, you know, one of the very big areas in our research right now is our work on concussion. We have an NIH grant where we are studying all of our 500 Division I athletes at Northwestern University and understanding more about the athlete brain, the healthy elite athlete brain, and also what happens to sound processing in the brain. What happens when an athlete sustains a concussion? And can we use sound processing to get a better understanding of how much injury an athlete has sustained and when it might be most healthy for them to return to play and return to learn? So this is an area that we're looking at. We're also very interested, you know, if you think of an athlete, again, you don't necessarily think of rhythm, but my goodness, you know, athletes are so rhythmic and they have to be anticipating and responding to each other's motions thoroughly. And so we're exploring the idea that rhythmic training can be something that can help, especially if someone has sustained a concussion, that some rhythmic training can perhaps lead a person to a faster and fuller recovery.
Yeah, and that's such important work. Well, before I let you go, one of the things that comes across on every page is you really enjoy your work at BrainVolts. And I'm wondering if you could maybe encapsulate that for us. Like, what do you most enjoy about your work there?
Well, I enjoy having conversations like this one. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I wrote this book. I really wanted to know what resonated with you. I love learning. You know, I figured out early on that, you know, when I went to graduate school, I got a stipend to be a graduate student, and they paid me to learn. And I thought, wow, this is incredible. And somehow I've managed to have a job where they pay me to learn. And it's so exciting for me to be with, to interact, to communicate, to learn from my colleagues at BrainVolts. And, you know, I get to speak with, you know, because sound processing in the brain encompasses so many areas like athletics and education and all of the different topics that we study, I am in the position to speak with people who are really wise and experienced in particular topics. And, you know, how wonderful and fun that is to get to do.
Well, Nina, it's been a joy to talk to you today, and enjoying this book. And one of the first things I thought of is I need to pass this book along to my friend Matt, our producer. I think he'll get a lot out of it, and highly recommend it to anyone who listens to sounds. You know, that's pretty much everybody. It's really fascinating because I'd never really considered how important sound was to my mind, although I knew it was. I'd never really thought deeply about it till reading this book.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, you said you're a physicist and you've taught about sound.
Sure.
You know, as I was writing that first part of the book, you know, how sound works, I'm like a kid. Tell me that story again. I love hearing the story about, you know, what is sound and you know, how does our brain make sense of it? And I just love to hear and tell and retell and think about that marvel again and again.
Thanks again to our guest, Nina Kraus. Her new book, Of Sound Mind, How Our Brain Constructs a Meaningful Sonic World, is available from most major booksellers. You can also check out the Brain Volts website at brainvolts.northwestern.edu. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio, and we're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. If you want to share or revisit this episode or check out our archives, visit mynspr.org. Never miss an episode. Subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.